And this is Bill Sisson, President of the Chamber, and I want to thank you all for joining us this morning. Nancy, I'll do a quick check. Can you hear me?
I can.
All right, thank you. Of course, these are challenging times for everyone on the phone call. I know that you're working hard to pivot and adjust, and so certainly appreciate your time. The Chamber is doing our very best. We're working to provide information and resources to help you and your business with this fast-moving situation. That's really what this call is about and all the other information that we're distributing right now. We are also, of course, fielding calls and happy to do so to help those of you that need assistance one-on-one as much as we can. So we really want to provide that to you. This morning, we have Michael Burson, an attorney at Adams & Reese. I think many of you know Michael. He'll explain what's included in the Federal Disaster Relief Funding Bill and what it means for your business. Before I introduce Michael officially, I did want to mention two things. One, because of the large number of folks calling in, this is a muted call so we can control the background noise. And so there will not be a Q&A session, but we will take any questions that you have via email. Would ask that you email those to Nancy Houston on the Chamber staff. And Nancy's email address is nhouston@mobilechamber.com. So that's nhouston@mobilechamber.com. Nancy Houston, and you, of course, can find that email address on our website. There will also be a recording of this session this morning, and that will be made available to all of you afterwards if you would like to share it. So let me introduce Michael. Michael has extensive experience on Capitol Hill within various governmental agencies. He formerly served as the Director of Government Affairs and Associate General Counsel of the National Small Business Administration in D.C., so he certainly knows how to navigate his way around SBA and has a good understanding, I believe, of how this is going to work. He also oversaw all legislative activities, including prioritization of issues, development of policy decisions, and the formulation of strategies to advance small business interests before Congress and the White House. He has agreed to join us this morning and provide some insight how we can navigate this as businesses. So with no further ado, I'm going to turn it over to you, Michael. Michael, thank you so much for being with us this morning and sharing.
Thank you, Bill, and thanks to everybody at the Chamber. I think y'all have really done a fantastic job during these unprecedented times to get the information out to your membership, and it shows that you are there and y'all are there every step of the way during their time of dire need. I think right now, I think it's apparent that this virus, in essentially an instant, has transformed the way we think, the way we shop and travel and eat, even the way we manufacture goods and provide services. That said, I firmly believe that our community here in this region is one of the most dynamic and innovative sectors of our economy here and really the backbone of our region. This is a time where I see everybody pulling together and walking us through this process that we're all going to be in for, looks like, the foreseeable future. What I'm going to do this morning is essentially kind of walk you all through, do a little play-by-play and bring you all up to speed about how we got here. Then I'll discuss after that a little bit more specifics about some of the provisions that were included in COVID-3, which is this third round of stimulus with regard to small businesses. And then we'll, of course, field any questions that Nancy gets. If it's an answer that I right now don't know the answer to, I'm happy to get back to you on that. So the way that this all started, of course, it's Congress's chief role is that they control the purse strings, so they control federal money. What they're in the process of doing now, they've passed two bills. They're going to be passing a total right now of three major pieces of legislation, which all three together are designed to not only respond to the public health crisis, but also address the huge kind of economic devastation that has followed. So on March 6th, Congress passed the first bill, which was really designed to get more resources to the federal agencies that were on the front line of this crisis. So that's Department of Health and Human Services, the CDC, and other federal agencies that were dealing with things from testing and related issues to vaccine development. At the time when that first bill was passed back in early March, it was a huge supplemental emergency appropriations bill. It was drafted to the tune, I think, of roughly $8.3 billion that sent that money to those agencies so they could then support the work and the research that their staff needed in order to respond to COVID. The second bill, shortly thereafter, I believe it was Saturday morning on March 14th, the second bill was passed by Congress. This one was a little bit different in that it was designed to deal more so with the economic crisis that was kind of accompanying that public health crisis. That bill largely expanded unemployment insurance and created some emergency sick leave provisions for affected workers. They also tried to essentially get people access to free testing for COVID. I mentioned that the paid leave for people losing their jobs and those having to take time off work to care for either sick family members or children who are now out of school. This second bill was largely negotiated between Pelosi and Mnuchin. Surprisingly, the two of them actually have a very good working relationship. They kind of started together negotiating this larger kind of social safety net package. It was during these negotiations that, you know, at this time, folks really started to realize the scope and the scale of this public health and economic crisis, and that folks would need to put their political differences aside and simply get something done for Americans. That bill, I haven't seen a final figure that's kicked it around, but I know it's the hundreds of billions of dollars. That kind of brings us up to where we are today. Last night, the Senate passed with overwhelming bipartisan support, I believe it's a margin of 96-0, the third stimulus bill, or COVID-3, as some folks are calling it, which is your classic large-scale stimulus program. The way this kind of came together was the administration initially started with $850 billion proposal. As Congress and staff began to work on it, that proposal quickly became $1 trillion, and now it's evolved into roughly a $2 trillion package that's in essentially two parts, which I'll explain in a little bit. The reason why it has taken this bill longer to move through and navigate through the process than the first two bills was because this third bill is a stimulus bill. A lot of people will probably remember back in 2008 when we had TARP. I think that was around $700 billion or something like that. Any time you are negotiating a measure of this scale and this magnitude and you start talking about propping up the entire economy, you're going to have some of these ideological differences. They become sharper. They become more defined. So it becomes more difficult to pass something like this. Also, I just mentioned TARP. That's something that is in the back of a lot of people's minds up there in D.C., whether it's members or staff. You know, that's the roughly $700 billion bailout. You know, both conservative Republicans and progressive Democrats feel like this was kind of a Wall Street bailout. Now, that bill and that whole effort really on the right gave rise to kind of the anti-government spending sentiment that kind of gave rise to the Tea Party, and on the left, it was Occupy Wall Street. So that is very fresh in people's minds up there, but I think the issue that they're dealing with is the potential ripple effect that a measure of this size and this magnitude will be the dominant theme, and they're trying to figure out how to approach this from a public health perspective and an economic crisis perspective. So I mentioned last night the Senate passed this bill. House is expected to pass it, I believe, at some point on Friday via voice vote, after which it'll immediately go to the president's desk for his signature. There's been some discussion going back whether they could pass it under UC, which is unanimous consent. I think largely the two main parties have their members kind of in line and coalesce. But there are a few folks out there, and as you all know, out of 435 members, there's going to be somebody out there that is going to make some noise, but hopefully it's after this bill passes. So now I'll kind of get into the specifics of COVID-3. It's really, as I mentioned before, kind of two parts. There's the $342 billion emergency supplemental measure, which actually becomes a part of the larger kind of $2 trillion phase three stimulus package. That package is it's a Senate amendment to the House bill. It's H.R. 748, which they're using that essentially as the vehicle to move this stimulus package. So a number of different agencies and programs are funded under COVID-3. I'll start kind of at the top with Health and Human Services. That funding totals about $140.4 billion. $100 billion of that is going to be going to the Public Health and Social Services Emergency Fund. This is to reimburse healthcare providers for healthcare expenses or lost revenue that are directly attributable to COVID. Funding could go to public entities, to providers enrolled in Medicare and Medicaid, and other for-profit and non-profit entities that provide diagnoses and tests or care for individuals with COVID. In addition to that $100 billion, there's about $27 billion for public health and social services. This is for things like vaccines and countermeasures and medical surge capacity, things that we're hearing a lot about in the news now. There's also about $4.3 billion for the CDC and another $3.5 billion for actually the Administration for Children and Families, which is Child Care and Dependent Block Grant Program. This is to help provide support for child care providers, which I know are also hurting in this, that are closed or have had a significant drop in their enrollment. So what they're trying to do with this bill and these funds that they're going to be rolling out is they're trying to make sure this is kind of a holistic approach to prop up the entire economy. In addition to HHS, there are some other reporting requirements that may not necessarily be relevant to folks on the call, but the lab reporting changes and things of that nature. I'm happy to get into those specifics. If you have a specific question, please feel free to email Nancy, and I'll get back to you all on that. With regard to DOT, the Department of Transportation, they're going to receive a little over $31 billion. $25 billion of that is going to be going to FTA, which is the Federal Transit Administration, for grants. This is going to help provide operating expenses, including lost revenue and purchasing of protective equipment, things and preventative maintenance and cleaning of those transit systems and services. Another $10 billion is going to FAA for the Airport Improvement Program, or the AIP. At least $500 million of that will be available to allow essentially 100% federal share for grants under the FY20 appropriations bill. The bill would also provide a separate $56 million for essential air services that preserves, especially in rural areas, the state and the country, operations at smaller airports. The funding for USDA and the food programs, there's about $15.8 billion for mandatory funding for SNAP, $9.5 billion that's going to be going to the Secretary's Office of Ag to provide aid to agricultural producers. I think that's certainly going to be in interest of folks throughout the state of Alabama, but also generally in the Mobile area as well. Another $8.8 billion for child nutrition programs. Something else that I think is going to be critical is the funding that's going to be going to the Department of Education. The Stimulus 3 bill would provide or create, an Education Stabilization Fund. It's going to be funded at roughly $30.8 billion. The Secretary is going to hold back about 2% for certain specified purposes and then divide the remaining portions up with 43.9% going to elementary and secondary schools for emergency relief grants, and then 46.3% for higher ed. There's also going to be roughly 10%, I think it's about 9.8% actually, for grants to state governors. Also, I want to make sure it's important to note that this assistance could go to non-public schools as well in some instances, because it's not just the public schools that are going to be hurting, it's the parochial schools and the private schools that are going to be hurting as well. The measure also provides roughly $100 million for what they're calling safe schools and citizenship education. This can be used by elementary, secondary, and kind of post-secondary schools for doing everything from cleaning effective schools to counseling and distance learning. There are also additional funds that are going to be going out to FEMA and DHS. $45.9 billion, I believe, goes to Homeland Security. $45 billion is going to be going to FEMA Disaster Relief Fund, and then another $400 million will be provided for grants that are going to be actually overseen by FEMA. So that's something that I think a lot of folks in this area definitely need to keep an eye on, or certain buckets of funds and grant monies that are going to be available for folks. In addition to FEMA, HUD programs are going to be funded, looks like very well, $5 billion for the Community Development Fund, which essentially funds the CDBG program. Luckily, there's going to be $4 billion in there for homeless assistance grants, another $1 billion for project-based rental assistance. So these are some important things to actually keep the to help support the entire economy and our entire region. So I think we will definitely see some benefits from that. Other agencies, in addition to those MAID agencies, the Department of Commerce is getting roughly $1.9 billion. 1.5 of that is going to be going to EDA, which is the Economic Development Administration. This is to respond to economic injuries resulting from COVID, so definitely keep your eye on that. You know, the members of Congress and their staff, as they're putting this bill together, certainly did not leave out our local law enforcement. They're including $1 billion for the Department of Justice. $850 million is going to be for state and local law enforcement. The Small Business Administration, which I'll get into the specifics here in just a second, is getting $562 million for disaster loans. The Department of Labor is going to get $360 million, of which $345 is going to be going directly to the Employment Training Administration. This is something that I think is should be of interest and very critical to a lot of the businesses on the call, is that you are able, as we are doing social distancing, and as we're working from home, and forever how long that is, you're going to need to be able to train new employees, and you can't go into the office to train new employees. So some of these funds that labor is going to have, you're going to be able to use those for those types of purposes. They're also funding for the National Endowment of the Arts and National Endowment of the Humanities and the Corporation of Public Broadcasting, $75 million. So they're not forgetting the arts. They're not forgetting all the nonprofits out there that depend on and have seen their donations drop drastically and will in the future see them drop significantly moving forward. So they're trying to figure out a way to support everybody in the community, and I think it really is. This is a bill that's going to help the entire Mobile region. The Army Corps of Engineers is also getting about $70 million. I know we have some ongoing projects here in the area, so that knowing that funding is going to be available for ongoing projects, but really for any kind of COVID-related projects that they may have to implement during this crisis, it's good to know that they're going to be fully funded at this point, I should say. Other changes to the measure, these are some things. I know a lot of people have heard about Real ID and the requirements of getting the STAR, essentially, on our driver's license. That's being delayed at least until September 30th, 2021. They're also extending some other things, Department of Homeland Security's chemical facility standards and things like that. Those programs are getting extended to July 23rd of 2020. So some programs that were set to expire, they're basically kind of punting a little bit to give folks some time. I'm going to get into now, which may be of interest to a lot of folks on the call, some of the small business assistance that's going to be available. Small employers with 500 employees or less will be eligible to apply for these, they're calling them like business interruption loans, and also the disaster loans as well. Loans will be immediately available through the existing SBA-certified lenders. This includes banks, credit unions, and other financial institutions. And SBA is going to be required to actually streamline that process to bring additional lenders into the program. What they're trying to do internally at SBA is they're trying to get work within essentially the four corners of the statute, the authority that they have now the authority once they pass this third bill, that they're going to have to get this money out to y'all and to small businesses as quickly as possible. The folks at SBA, the folks here on the ground here in Alabama, the folks in D.C., and all their staff, they have been working around the clock since this crisis first started, and they are doing an absolutely fantastic job to facilitate, and their partners are as well. The SBDCs here in Alabama, a fantastic job of pushing information out to small businesses. The Secretary of Treasury under some of these small business provisions would be authorized to expedite the addition of these new lenders. The size of these small business loans would essentially be tied to the applicant's average monthly payroll, to mortgage, rent, utility payments, tied to those things as well, and other debt obligations over the previous year. What they're going to do is they're plussing up the loan amount So maximum amount would be about $10 million. This program, the way it's included in the bill, it's conditional upon businesses retaining their employees and the payroll levels during this covered period. They're defining this covered period as March 1, 2020 through June 30th, 2020. The reason why they made it retroactive, they're focusing on the employees. They want to keep people employed as long as they possibly can. So they're allowing businesses, by making it retroactive, for anybody who's unfortunately had to lay off employees or staff or put people from full-time to part-time, to bring them back on. So it's making it retroactive to help those businesses out, to bring people back on the payroll. Important to know is that the portion of the loan that's used to cover payroll and payments on other pre-existing debt would actually be forgiven. So it's more like a grant in that respect than essentially a loan. Also, employers with tipped employees will receive forgiveness for any additional wages paid to those employees during that covered period, so from March 1st, 2020 to June 30th, 2020. This bill provides roughly $300 billion to support these loan programs. In addition to those business interruption or economic injury loans, they are also in this bill expanding the allowable uses for the existing 7A program at SBA. They're doing that so they could permit payroll support, including paid sick leave, supply chain disruptions, employee salaries, mortgage payments, and other debt obligations, essentially to provide immediate access to capital for y'all and for the affected small businesses. The maximum also, there's another program, they're called SBA Express Loans. This number, the threshold amount is getting plussed up as well for these SBA Express Loans. That originally it was $350,000, now it's going to be $1 million. These loans essentially provide borrowers with a revolving line of credit for working capital purposes. I've been told that, you know, they can turn some of these SBA Express loans around in as quickly as 48 hours. The cost of the participation in the 7A program would be reduced both for the borrowers and the lenders, because I know we may have some lenders on this call as well, essentially by providing fee waivers, an automatic deferment of payments for the first year, and also no prepayment penalties, too. You know, one thing that they're doing, too, with this bill is they're not leaving out the entrepreneurs. So this bill provides also additional funding for counseling and training and relating assistance to entrepreneurs and startups. There's roughly, I think, $240 million going to SBA's small business development centers and women's business centers. There's no match also for women's business centers. So that would be waived for a period of 3 months. $10 million is going to be dedicated to the minority business development agencies, minority business centers, and then $25 million for grants to other associations kind of representing those types of resource partners. One other thing that I want to touch on, too, which is I know a lot of people have been reading about, a lot of small business also have been thinking about, too. So individuals are going to be eligible for checks up to $1,200. Married couples filing jointly are eligible for checks up to $2,400. This is with an extra $500 for each child. So the higher the income, the less money that's going to be received. I think the cutoff, the last I heard and last I read at least, was for individuals earning more than $99,000 and couples with a joint income above $198,000. So even people also with no income and those on Social Security will be receiving payments. So they're trying to get this money out into these people's hands as quickly as possible and then back into the economy. One thing that I think is weighing a lot on a lot of small business minds, or at least I believe it is the unemployment insurance. What they're doing is they're essentially enhancing unemployment insurance to the tune of, I believe, by $600 weekly up to 4 months. You know, this is something that has, of course, drawn objections from folks. You know, the concern is that this would essentially incentivize people not to go back to work. You know, this was meant to be coupled essentially with the state unemployment benefits to make some of these workers whole, for their 100% lost wages. You know, the argument, as I mentioned a second ago, is that this actually gives some employees a raise over what they were actually making and incentivizes them to not come back to work. What's important to know is that this is finite. you know, if I believe, and I don't have the exact language in front of me, but I believe, you know, if the job is offered back to the employee, they can't just sit back and continue to draw down unemployment benefits. And, you know, the way that Mnuchin and folks on the Hill and staff kind of looked at this is really this was the only way to ensure that states could get this money out as quickly as possible and in a fair way and a process as possible. I know I'm kind of getting close to my time, so I just want to say, you know, this is, you know, people are really unsure, you know, how long this businesses are going to be closed, you know, unclear how long workers are going to be impacted, and even, you know, if some of these jobs that, that have been eliminated or have been furloughed will ever come back. You know, I think so the real question is not how long this bill will last, but what does the next phase look like? There have already been discussions, folks on the Hill and also within the other business organizations and entities up there in D.C. and even here on the ground here in Mobile, we have already started talking about and working on phase four. So we're working on that now. It's something where, you know, they're going to pass this. The Senate's probably going to pass this. Senate passed the bill. House is probably going to pass it by Friday. They're going to be gone for I think, at least a couple of weeks. That does not mean staff has stopped working. The staff up there in D.C., whether it's the committee staff or agency staff, has really, just like, you know, the people at the grocery stores and the people, the sanitation workers and the janitorial services, these folks are really on the front line. They are out, you know, they're out of the office, but they are working around the clock to draft legislation. So we've already started talking about, we're working with some of our partners in Hill staff in D.C. on a phase four, because no one really knows the full scope of what is needed. So what phase four is going to be doing is going to try to keep people on this kind of plane, this level playing field, essentially, for months to come. You know, one thing that a lot of people aren't talking about now, which is good, because right now, in my opinion, this response needs to be as huge and aggressive as possible to support everyone, is that the vast majority of this funding is going to be supported by government borrowing for the foreseeable future. This is something we're unfortunately going to have to deal with. But, you know, the response that we need now is immediate, it's aggressive, and it needs to be huge, and it needs to help stabilize the entire economy. And I think that's what COVID-3 does, and that's what phase four is going to do as well. But, Bill, I'll turn this back to you. Hopefully I didn't go over my time, but thank you again. Everyone, I just want to say again, I mean, from Bill to Nancy to David to Shelby, to Maggie, to Bob, everybody, to Lee, everybody has done an absolutely fantastic job at the Chamber. You've got some great leadership there, and they're, you know, I think just the way they're pushing information out and where they're holding these calls, they're there to let you know they're there every step of the way. So thank you all again for the opportunity, and I'm here to answer any kind of questions that you all may have.
Well, you're right on time, Michael, and we can't thank you enough. We really appreciate that information. Realize that it was a lot to take in for everyone, so I'm sure that there are some questions, but we do ask that you email those questions to Nancy Houston at the Chamber, and her email address is N as in Nancy, Houston, H-E-W-S-T-O-N as in Nancy, at mobilechamber.com, and we'll get those questions to Michael and then get answers back to you as soon as we can. Also be looking for information about the recording of this presentation this morning, all on our website. We are totally revamping our website to make it more user-friendly related to COVID. We already have a link on the website which provides up-to-date information. But that will be even more user-friendly in the very near future. So go there for information, and we will provide it as soon as we have it. So, again, thank you all for joining the call today. We will be doing these 10 o'clock sessions every day. We'll have various experts locally, nationally, statewide, experts to help on these various subject matters. So thank you all, and we wish you the best, and we're here to help in any way we can. Thank you.